There are only 17 Republican women in the House today. The GOP struggling with its identity at the moment. Is gender a part of the problem? Now I'm talking about my women
problems, because I got me some women problems. Accusations of sexism are flying on Capitol Hill involving House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the National Republican Congressional Committee. Well, the NRCC put out a statement saying, quote, taxpayers can only hope McChrystal is able to put her in her place. Put her in her place? They want a man to put the first female Speaker of the House of Representatives in her place?
The GOP has been working hard to recruit women with disappointing results, but one high-profile conservative woman is making headlines. Is Sarah Palin the model for the new Republican woman? I need help with my women problems, because I can't escape my women problems. Women problems on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, November 17th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste. Also on the program, you may feel lucky if you have a job these days, but some research says workers are also feeling more magnanimous, dare we say, ethical on the job. And also reducing carbon to stop global warming. Al Gore gets a dose of super Freakonomics.
But first, New Jersey State Senator Jennifer Beck is joining us this morning. Jennifer, let me ask you, why is the GOP struggling now more than it was, say, 10 years ago to recruit women and get them elected into office?
I actually don't think we are struggling to recruit women. I actually was going to comment on that. I know my experience in New Jersey is that more women are stepping up to the plate and interested in running as a Republican. We're seeing a lot of women at the local, at the county, and at the state level very interested in running for office.
Okay. Do you feel Sarah Palin is a good role model for women in the Republican Party?
I think any time you have a woman running on a presidential ticket, that's a good thing for women. And I do think she was a good role model. She's someone that came from a modest beginning, mayor of her own town, became governor, and then eventually achieved the level of running for national office. And I think that is a positive role model for young women, no question.
One of the role models you've pointed to is Christy Todd Whitman, a former governor. And she's no longer in office. And some people say that women like Christy Todd Whitman and Didi Scozza-Fava in New York were pushed aside because they were moderate. Is there room for moderate women in the Republican Party?
Absolutely. I look around now, and of course you have the icons like Kay Bailey Hutchinson and Olympia Snow. But there are a whole group of young women that are coming up in the party, like Heidi Ganstrich, who's the Assembly Minority Leader in Nevada, and Lynn Finnegan, who's the Minority Leader in Hawaii, and Shannon Jones in the Ohio House.
Sounds like there's a lot of them. We're going to talk more about this in just a moment. That's New Jersey State Senator Jennifer Beck. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
现在请奥巴马总统致辞。
There's President Obama being introduced at a news conference in Beijing this morning where he says a revised economic policy would bring rewards to both the U.S. and China.
This will lead to increased U.S. exports and jobs on the one hand and higher living standards in China on the other.
The president spoke this week about Chinese censorship of the Internet. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Chinese-American student at the University of Pennsylvania, Jenny Jiang, who has friends and relatives in China. She told us the people she knows there are good at finding ways around any official control of the Internet.
Plenty of people use social media in China. And even if things are blocked like Facebook and Twitter, I think people in China are pretty innovative and find ways to get around these things.
Right now, the president is at a state dinner in his honor. He wraps his three-day trip to China in a few hours before traveling to South Korea.
And here at home, Sarah Palin's memoir comes out today. Been a bestseller for weeks thanks to pre-orders. We're going to have more about that book's significance in a few moments. The Dow jumped 136 points yesterday. It's going to just open just above 10,400. The S&P is hovering around 1,100, and the NASDAQ opens a shade under 2,200. So as we said, Sarah Palin's new book called Going Rogue hits shelves today. Does Sarah Palin have a sequel in her somewhere? And if so, what would be the title?
My title for Sarah Palin's second novel would be, Hey, Am I Relevant? You Betcha.
Tell us what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk more about that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
As John mentioned earlier, you can't escape Sarah Palin this week. That's because
new way.
Her autobiography is hitting shelves today. It's called Going Rogue, An American Life. And there was a lot of chatter yesterday about her appearance on Oprah.
Does that mean you're reloading for 2012?
I'm concentrating on 2010 and making sure that we have issues tackled as Americans to make sure that we're
would
on the right
even tell
road.
Would you tell me if thinking about it?
No, I wouldn't. Not on its own. Back.
She's not going to tell anybody if she's running again, but her book seems like it's setting up Sarah Palin for another run. One of the things she does in there, she constantly makes mention of Ronald Reagan, in some cases comparing herself to Ronald Reagan. And she also, during her book tour, is visiting all the battleground states. So to talk about this, we invited a couple guests with firsthand insight, Republican political consultant Mary Madeline and Christy Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey and head of the EPA under George Bush. They join us now. So Mary, let's start with you. As I said, she's visiting all the major battleground states during her book tour. Does this appear to you as a clear sign that she's going to be running again?
Not necessarily. I'm going to take off my political hat, put on my publishing hat. I worked for Simon & Schuster, run the Threshold line, and it would be disingenuous for any publisher to not send her to places where she can sell the most number of books. But as the governor will tell you, you can't run till you're ready to run, and she's not. I don't see this as necessarily a precursor to a run.
Do you not think she's ready to run quite yet?
I don't. Please, let's not take that out of context. You're not, I mean, ready to run in the sense that you can't have a strategy until it's clear what kind of environment you're working in and running in. And right. I am presuming from my 30 years of working in politics that the 2012 environment is going to look considerably different after the midterms of 2010.
So Christy, there is actually a lot of discussion about the role of women in the GOP right now. There's only about less than 10% of House Republicans are women, and 10% of the Republican senators are women. Why are there so few females in the GOP right now compared to Democrats?
Well, frankly, I don't think either party has done the job they could or should do with women. But when I look at it, I look down the ballot a little bit, and the numbers get even more sort of dislocated at the state legislature level and the lower level, the mayoral level. And that's where we need to really put our focus and be encouraging of women. But I've always found that women hold each other to a higher standard than they do their male counterparts. And that's been part of the challenge that women, particularly in the Republican Party, I think have had. That women don't support them in the way that we might support a man coming to us with the same kind of background, the same kind of credentials, and the same position on issues. And why that would be more prevalent in the Republican Party than in the Democrat Party, I don't know. But I don't think either party has come anywhere near to doing what they should be doing to encourage women to run.
There seems to be, there is an identity crisis going on in the Republican Party right now, kind of a characterized by the recent race in northern New York. Here's a Didi Scazzafava. She spoke on the Rachel Maddow show last week.
Any party that just tries to purge members that might have any sort of independent thinking, I think eventually will run itself into very much of a minority status.
Mary, some people have said that this identity crisis is partly over women, because women in the Republican Party often, statistically at least, tend to be more centrist than their male counterparts. And there appears to be a split in the Republican Party between the more moderate members of the party and those who are further to the right.
This is an old argument that got started over the abortion issue, which was much bigger than the actual act of abortion for women. But the legacy of that argument and what's a moderate and what's a conservative and all that, that's not how women think. Women are practical. And if you want to label them, I'd say they're more purple and practical than anything else. And this sort of purging and all of that business is just a all template right. that the press loves.
Okay, well, then Mary, let's just ask it directly. Does Sarah Palin have a constituency within the GOP leadership, the people who are going to determine how the campaign goes after 2010, or is she auditioning at this point?
The GOP leadership does not determine who the GOP candidates are. That was the problem in New York 23. A bunch of men behind closed doors picked a candidate. The why I joined the Republican Party is because I'm a conservative. I'm a conservative before I'm a Republican, and conservatives tend to be grassroots people. They listen to candidates. They connect. They like retail politics.
Right, I understand, Mary. But
the notion that there's some bosses that are going to pick the candidates is wrong.
But the men picked Sarah Palin. All I'm saying is she a tried and true political asset, or is she someone who's just out in the fringe?
The only way to know that is to look at the polls, and the polls are split on her. Is she polarizing? Yes. Is Barack Obama polarizing? Yes. He's the most polarizing president in history, and the fastest falling approval ratings in history. No one talks about him being out on the fringe, but he's as polarizing as she is. So she, which means people love her, which the press tends not to focus on. Equal numbers of people love her more than they love other would-be candidates, and with the same intensity that people don't like her.
Well, Christy, let me ask you, because I have a dear friend who's a longtime Republican, who when Sarah Palin was nominated and all the to-do over Sarah Palin and in her interview with Katie Couric and all those other things, my friend was really insulted that Sarah Palin was the choice because she felt there were so many other talented and brilliant Republican women who could have been chosen. And I have to ask you, you know, with so many people saying perhaps Sarah Palin is the future of women in the GOP, I'm wondering what your reaction is to that.
Well, there's certainly a portion of the GOP that's very attracted to her. There's no question about that. She did what she was supposed to do, I guess, but what they wanted her to do in the McCain campaign, which was energize the base. So the irony is they did get the base out, and we still got our heads handed to us. So that should be a lesson there. Now, I agree with what Mary said earlier about the women, and certainly in the Republican Party, being practical and pragmatic. And we're getting marginalized because there are certain social issues that are being used now as a litmus test to determine your suitability for office. And that just isn't the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be solving problems, the problems that the people in general care about. And most people don't sit down over their dining room table and worry about abortion rights or gay marriage. They worry about, can they pay the rent? What are they going to do about medication? What are they going to do with their children's education? And that's where we need our focus. Obviously, Sarah Palin is someone that appeals to a certain faction within the party, but I don't think it's the faction that you can use to build upon to have a successful nationwide coalition and become a really vibrant party again.
And we're going to have to end it there. Christy, thank you so much. That's Christy Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey and former head of the EPA under George W. Bush. Also, Mary Madeline, longtime Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you. And Sarah Palin's book, as you probably know, you couldn't have missed it, Going Rogue, is hitting the shelves today. We're asking you, name her next book. What would you call the next chapter in the life of the former Alaskan governor? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeofthetakeaway.org. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on some of the top stories.
President Obama and his host, Chinese President Hu Jintao, emerged from hours of talks determined to demonstrate cooperation today. The president had some positive words about China's role in America's economic recovery.
So far, China's partnership has proved critical in our effort to pull ourselves out of the worst recession in generations.
President also enjoyed a tourist visit to certain areas in China. He said in Beijing, the Forbidden City was a must-see stop on his visit.
As we've been saying, Sarah Palin's new book, Going Rogue, is out today. Here she is on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
I have a message, and the message, I think, is written well and articulately in the book about where I think America could go and should go and about the unity in America that we need in order to progress.
The book's already a pre-sale bestseller. Moving on to the healthcare debate, the figures are out on who's spending what on TV ads. Opponents of healthcare reform spent $24 million on TV commercials over the past month. That's $24 million in a month. That outpaced the supporters of healthcare reform 2-1. And finally, the new Oxford American Dictionary has unveiled its word of the year. Do you know what it is, John?
Actually, you mentioned it last hour. It's unfriend.
Unfriend.
I think that's a good choice.
A verb invented by users of the social networking site Facebook. It describes when you remove someone from your friend list. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Unfriend. Unfriend is the correct way to say that. There's a briefing scheduled for later today on the Fort Hood shootings, and the politics is already getting very, very noisy. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes with Todd Zwillick.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Takeout time. Good morning. Dateline Washington. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. I have one question for you, Todd. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
How does the Fort Hood shooting and the decision by Eric Holder, the attorney general, to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to New York for a trial become suddenly a showcase to criticize the White House on security issues?
Well, because there are public hearings scheduled, and you're going to be seeing a lot more of that sort of confluence of seemingly unrelated events. John, there was a closed briefing scheduled yesterday for senators on the Hill about the Fort Hood shootings, and that briefing was supposed to be given by military brass. The generals and the Secretary of the Army were going to come and brief senators. The hearing was canceled and has been rescheduled and made into a classified briefing today, and the generals aren't coming. White House staff, the National Security Council, I'm told, is coming to brief senators, and now senators, Republican senators, aren't happy about it. They think the White House is trying to manage a political message, and the message that Republicans allege they're trying to manage is that the White House is making poor decisions about the war that we're in. Listen to Jeff Sessions. He's on the Judiciary Committee. He's going to be doing a lot of public questioning this week, and he's drawing a parallel now between Fort Hood and between Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And you're going to get an idea of where he's going with this.
I think this shooting at Fort Hood, combined with the trial in New York of terrorists, I do think it raises serious questions about the administration's approach to the war on terror. They want to see it as a criminal activity rather than a war. And I don't know why.
Now, John, today's briefing is closed and classified, but Eric Holder, the Attorney General, comes up on the Hill tomorrow in the Judiciary Committee. Then the Homeland Security Committee has a public hearing Thursday. And I think what you're going to see is Republicans on those committees drawing parallels between what they see as an improper decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in civilian court.
Well, but there's nothing they can do about it. I mean, they can talk about it, but there's nothing statutorily they can do about it at this point, except maybe take money away from somebody. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Now let's go to sports with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, I don't really want to talk about the football game last night between the Ravens and the Browns.
It was so exciting.
Baltimore won 16-0, and considering the extremely exciting game we had over the weekend with the Colts and the Patriots, last night was...
It was the exact
snoozer.
It was definitely the exact opposite, but this gives us a chance to peel back and think about what is a week in the life of a typical NFL player. Usually they have Mondays, which they're kind of going over the last week game. Tuesday is their mandated day off. Wednesday and Thursday are their tough practice days. And then Thursday and Friday are sort of getting into like lighter days and then going into Saturday where they travel. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because right now the NFL Players Association is looking into investigating and speaking with Cleveland Browns players because head coach Eric Mangini, who is an understudy of Bill Belichick, who's the coach at New England Patriots.
Who is a real chucklehead, by the way, Eric Mangini.
So Mangini, who's been under fire for his 1-8 record with the Browns this season, they've been accusing. He's been calling these opportunity sessions, which is these extra practices.
But it makes you feel better about them because they're called opportunities.
Opportunity sessions. And if you've ever played football in a high school or in a college, sometimes you'll lose a game and then the coach will be like, your coach will get you guys on the practice field right after the game and force you into drills. It's similar to that, except these are pro players. And a lot of the players are saying, including Jamal Lewis, a running back, is saying that they feel, and he retracted these statements, but he said that they're tired, that they're exhausted, that they're worn out. And
well, the tough approach isn't exactly working. The Cleveland Browns are 1-8, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think so this is something I think we'll be following a little bit, is looking, is the NFL Players Association going to play a role in helping to sort of mitigate this for the players?
And the question is, at this point, well, we have a lot of people who are injured at this point in the season, and is it helpful to wear them out when there's so many people going down?
And that's a great point. This past weekend, a lot of people that were contending for playoff spots had key players get injured. And most notably, Brian Westbrook of the Philadelphia Eagles suffered his second concussion. So when he may not come back for the season, and I wouldn't advise him to come back. So that's a great point. And I think this is an interesting point in the season to see who's going to weather this storm and be able to come out on top.
Okay. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is a Takeaways sports contributor. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Thank you. Good morning.
And our final takeout, because it's a family show, our last takeout concerns our conversation yesterday about the tensions of kids coming home from college for the holidays. You said, stop the whining, you guys.
This is Michelle Yurecka from Morristown, New Jersey. I'm a little sick of all of these news stories covering college students coming home and living at home after graduation. Kids have come home from college for hundreds of years, and they've been coming home and living with their parents after graduating for probably about as long. This is just yet another example of self-absorbent naval contemplation by baby boomers, and I think enough is enough.
Hi, my name is Steven. I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Most of these college kids returning home are still under the age of 21, and the presumption was that they would be drinking, when the reality is most of them are still underage.
They also got some flack when he played this John Coltrane song on the anniversary of The Sound of Music yesterday.
This is Dan from Katona, New York. Thanks for the great story on Sound of Music. However, my favorite thing, that great version by Coltrane, was obviously soprano sax, not the tenor sax.
You are right, Dan. Thank you very much.
Poor Jack Grace. He said, when we rehearsed it, he said soprano.
He said tenor.
And I went, oh, Jack. But, you know,
yeah,
boom.
That's the way it goes.
The moment passed.
That's one of my favorite songs from as a child.
Yeah.
Finally, listen to this. We talked yesterday about In Cold Blood and reminiscences of the book 50 years after Truman Capote began to write it. In 1969, Frank wrote, I was in 10th grade, and In Cold Blood was one of the first reading assignments given to my English class. Began the book, soon found it unreadable, terrifying, horrible. I muddled through by skimming. It had a huge impact on me, and I swore I would never go near this story again. Years later, after reading most of Capote's other works, which I enjoyed, I still avoided In Cold Blood. I found I had to deal with that in the movie theater during a screening of Capote. I sat through it, thought it was quite a good film and performance, and faced my fears. I do have to say, that was an inordinately stupid reading assignment for a 14-year-old.
I agree, Frank.
Great
Let
story.
Us know your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, Freakonomics author Stephen Dubner. It's day two of his week spending it with The Takeaway, and he's going to get super freaky on global warming and talk about the blowback he received from all of his suggestions on what's the solution to global warming. But let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Hunger is on the rise in the U.S. New government figures show 17 million American households, or 15% of the nation, had a difficult time putting enough food on the table at some point last year, and that's an 11% increase over 2007. Sarah Palin. Palin's memoir hits bookshelves today. Officially, in it, she answers some of the criticism she's faced from the McCain camp after the election. And here, Palin tells Oprah Winfrey about the aftermath of her shaky interview with Katie Couric.
The campaign said, right on, good, you're showing your independence, this is what America needs to see. And it was a good interview. And of course, I'm thinking, if you thought that was a good interview, I don't know what a bad interview was, because I knew it wasn't a good interview.
More interviews. Palin's book, Going Rogue in American Life, has been a bestseller for weeks. She's on a book tour. It's all thanks to pre-orders.
President Obama, speaking in Beijing this morning, spoke about an agreement reached with the Chinese government on climate change.
As President Hu indicated, we are creating a joint clean energy research center and have achieved agreements on energy efficiency, renewable energy, cleaner uses of coal, electric vehicles, and shale gas.
President said U.S. and China have agreed to take significant steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Aww, freak out.
Ooh, Freakonomics.
Day two of our Freakonomics week here with Stephen Dubner, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog, and the new book, Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
As you can hear from President Obama speaking in Beijing, despite the sense of agreement in what he's saying, there's actually not a consensus among world leaders of what to do about global warming, but not so in Super Freakonomics. There seems to be a very strong consensus in your book that since we socially engineered ourselves into this carbon problem in the atmosphere, we can geoengineer our way out of it. And sulfur dioxide is one component of your solution to the global warming problem. Explain, could you?
Yeah, sure. Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that this is the be-all and end-all solution. This
right.
is the only way out.
Right.
What we're saying is that, you know, kind of imagine that you build a house and you do everything you can to not have a fire in the house. You teach your kids to not play
right.
with matches. You put a screen on your fireplace. That said, you want a sprinkler system. And the question we're looking at is this. If the world is getting dramatically and dangerously hotter, what do you do to cool it down? And our answer is that carbon mitigation does not seem to be the solution for a variety of reasons.
Carbon mitigation being the sort
reduction
of
burning
less fossil fuel, essentially.
Right. Socially right. Changing our behaviors on a huge scale.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then we do propose some geoengineering solutions that we think should be on the table. What's interesting about it, if you take a step back, you have to acknowledge this very, very central and important point. We've already geoengineered the Earth a lot. We've taken about 300 million years' worth of accumulated carbon fuels and burned them in the space of a couple centuries.
But we didn't do it with one hose and one tailpipe. We did it with a lot of little, tiny little tailpipes. And your solution does call for one big sulfur dioxide hose in the atmosphere. Explain.
Right. So there's a portfolio of what you call geoengineering solutions. They're all over the map. The most repugnant one, the one that most environmentalists and most of us, most humans, would find repugnant is one that's called a stratoshield, okay. Which means basically, yeah, you put a long garden hose to the sky, suspended on helium balloons, and spritz sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere.
Don't wreck our show, you hoser.
So sulfur dioxide at that scale in the atmosphere?
The reason for this, it's attempting to mimic what happens in nature with volcanoes. So when you have a really big volcano blow, the last really big one we had was Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991.
Sure.
And what it does when you have a really, you know, volcanoes are blowing up all the time, all over, putting sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere all the time. They don't often get their junk up into the stratosphere, which starts about 6 or so miles up above the Earth's surface, so usually in the troposphere, where it falls back more locally as acid rain. When you get it into the stratosphere, things behave differently at that altitude. The chemical mixes with the water vapor there and forms a kind of aerosol cloud that literally blankets the Earth. What that did after Pinatubo was cool the ground temperature by a matter of a degree or so for a period of 2 years.
Now, okay, sounds like a great lab experiment, but how can you do that on a planetary scale, and what kinds of cooperation would it require? And it could go terribly wrong. I mean, you could turn Cameroon into sulfur dioxide land.
Yeah, well, the science suggests, and again, you're absolutely right. The big problem is you can't experiment. It's one of the problems with talking about climate in general, kind of like talking about the macroeconomy in general. You only have one. And so whenever we try to predict what will happen to the macroeconomy or even describe what did happen, the big problem is you don't have experimentation. You don't have a bunch of conditions that you can examine. What the science suggests is that the amount of sulfur dioxide needed to do the job would be less than 1% of the sulfur dioxide that's currently being sent into the atmosphere by a combination of natural sources, volcanoes and salt spray, and man-made burning.
All right. I still don't get how you do it with one source, but suffice it to say
that
scientists...
You'll have to read
the book, John. Right. Well, scientists say that this is absurd and insane. In fact, to dismiss social change as a way of dealing with carbon mitigation is just because it's too hard... is irresponsible.
Well, some scientists say that it's absurd, and some scientists were testifying before Congress the other day, which held its first ever geoengineering hearings, to say we need to get geoengineering on the table, including a fellow that we wrote about in Super Freak named Ken Caldera, who's a very well-regarded climate scientist, but also the Royal Society of in the UK, which is comprised of, you know, some of the best scientists in the world, have put out essentially a white paper on geoengineering, arguing that, again, this needs to be on the table. Paul Crutzen, an atmospheric scientist who won the Nobel and who's generally called Dr. Ozone for his examination of how the ozone must be protected, came out and basically wrote an essay that many scientists hated. He said, look, of course it would be great if we could burn a whole lot less carbon. And we have grossly failed at that task. Therefore, we should be considering something like geoengineering. So I think it is a vast overstatement to say that scientists don't like the idea, because there are a lot of scientists, including climate scientists, who look to this as potentially the sprinkler system in your house that you need.
You know, having read the book, Stephen, and you know, there's you propose several solutions to several problems, the hurricane mitigation in the ocean and this particular hose reaching up into the stratosphere. And what occurred to me was that, you know, those, I mean, number one, the hose, you can shut it off if it's starting to have adverse effects. I started to wonder, why don't we try these things? Why? How come every single experiment becomes an emotional and political issue on global warming? That it's all, you're a bad, you are now, you, Stephen Dunder, are bad. You're a bad man.
Very bad man. I'm an earth hater. Yeah.
You are.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I mean, I understand people's passion about the issue. I'm passionate about it myself. But why are you bad for proposing other ideas?
Well, I think there's a few reasons. One is, as John said, it's hard to experiment on the whole earth.
Right.
Which is why you look for natural experiments. volcanoes being one. In fact, there are substances that would be probably better than sulfur dioxide, but we have the proof of working, and we have the proof of harmlessness in sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere after Pinatubo. In terms of why it's so bad, look, you got to realize there are a lot of people who spent a lot of time and invested a lot of resources, human capital and capital.
Right. I mean, there's a vested interest in this position, mitigation position. But have you changed your outlook because of the blowback you've gotten? Have you modified anything in the book as a result?
We changed one sentence. Where one scientist who had been asked to vet the manuscript and did and gave a lot of comments twice, later said that there was one sentence that he hadn't read well and wanted us to change it. So we did that. But in terms of the biggest result, I'd say is
very quick.
We argued that the movement to stop global warming has the feel of a religion. I think, if anything, we should strengthen that sentence, because what's been issued here is essentially a fatwa for entertaining alternate theories.
And the super freakonomics religion has no fatwas in its liturgy. And you can read the liturgy of super freakonomics in super freakonomics. Stephen Dummer is back with us tomorrow to talk about human nature. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Super freakonomics.
You hoser.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. And this is Sarah Palin.
I have a message, and the message, I think, is written well and articulately in the book about where I think America could go and should go, and about the unity in America that we need in order to progress.
I'm sure you haven't heard before now, but the former VP candidate's new book is out, Going Rogue, An American Life.
It took Barack Obama two books to make it to the White House, and so where is Sarah Palin headed? We're wondering about the future of Sarah Palin and whether there's a sequel in her future, and what would you call it?
Hi, this is Mitch from Brooklyn, Sarah Palin's next book, Going Rouge, How My Pretty Face Almost Helped Me Become the Vice President of the United States.
We've been getting some pretty creative ideas from you at 8778-MY-TAKE and mytake@thetakeaway.org.
My title for Sarah Palin's second novel will be, Hey, Am I Relevant? You Betcha.
Hi, this is Norm from Illinois. I'm looking forward to reading Sarah Palin's next book, How I Turned Into a Dominatrix in Order to Whip the Republican Party into Shape.
I mean, basically, you guys aren't making many deposits in the good karma bank here.
Hey, Troy calling from Dakota. Hockenberry, you magnificent bastard. You've done it again. The Palin sequel should be titled, obviously, American Chucklehead, My Improbable Rise to Infamy.
Hi, Younger Day, Yorktown, Virginia. I think Sarah Palin's new book should be Quitting for Dummies.
Craig from New Jersey. I think that in the long run, she's toxic for the party. I would say Sarah Palin's follow-up book would probably be something along the lines of Dear GOP, Sorry.
And hey, we don't control 8778-MY-TAKE.
Jane in Brooklyn emails us, I can only hope her next book is entitled Going Away for Good.
Good morning, this is Chris from Brooklyn. Second Palin book? Let's see, how about Diary of a Cardboard Cutout? A Blatant Opportunist Speaks.
This is Amity X from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It should be untitled and unwritten. After all of the inaccuracies, to put it mildly, in her folksy policy tome, she really doesn't deserve to get another opportunity to have a book ghostwritten for her.
Hi, this is Heather. I'm calling from New Jersey. What about the title, The Perfect Republican Puppet for the Americans of 2010 through 2012?
The next book will be Going, Going, Gone, I certainly hope. Betsy Powell, Dartmouth, Massachusetts.
Kind of makes you want to just join Sarah Palin on her book tour, right? Just going to Dartmouth, Massachusetts, all these friendly places. Now, we did get some sympathy. I mean, it's got to be tough for any woman stepping out to talk about the future of the GOP.
With the way that you people in the media treat Republican women, period, why would women want to become part of the political process when they're drugged through the dirt like that?
And he's got a point. How about a one that's a little bit more bipartisan?
It's Joe from Jersey.
Sarah Palin's next book should be Going Commando.
<That's nice. laughs> We want to hear your ideas. Great ideas from our listeners. They're always very creative and witty. They're just, you know, a little bit on the harsh side today. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The audacity of running for president again. How about that? That's a good title.
I were going to do the title, I've looked at the schedule for her book tour. If I were going to title it, I would say, I am woman, I am strong, I am tired.
Jay, get us Helen ready. Do you have time? We've only got about 9 seconds. That's our director, Jay Cowan. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We've obviously struck a chord, and keep them coming. MyTakeAtTheTakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we talk about work every Tuesday and huddling together in these dark economic times. Does it make for kinder and gentler and, dare we say, more ethical workplaces? We'll find out in just a moment. Also, Sarah Palin, her new book is called Going Rogue, An American Life. Our producer, Rob Hugh Jones, says, what if she had a sequel? We asked you and got some answers.
Sarah Palin's next book should be I Am Not Tina Fey. Not by a wide margin.
Keep them coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, here's a check on leading stories. At 48 minutes past the hour, President Obama and his Chinese counterpart Hu Jintao have given a joint news conference in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing. The president urged China to resume dialogue with the Dalai Lama. Hu Jintao criticized economic protectionism. Both leaders promised a joint effort to tackle climate change. There were also talks about Afghanistan and Pakistan. We checked out the menu at tonight's state banquet for the president. In case you were wondering, he dined on chicken soup with bean curd, Chinese-style beef steak, and roasted grouper. We don't know anything about whether dim sum was passed or if the president ate the duck feet.
And back at home, we've been talking this morning about how Guantanamo Bay detainees may get moved from Cuba to the American mainland. There's fierce debate about this. Earlier, we spoke to Representative Mike Boland, who's in favor of the idea.
This will actually bring in over 3,000 jobs. And also, there'll probably be about 1,000 additional jobs in schools and restaurants and motels and other ancillary economic development.
Some Republicans in Illinois are against the idea of bringing terrorism suspects to the United States. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
All right, everybody, to talk about work this morning, we want you all to sit down, stop what you're doing, and just take a hard look inside your own soul. We've got a serious recession going, and what's the impact on your life? Are you getting a little more desperate? Are you getting a little more nasty? Or are you noticing that things are actually improving, that we're all kind of holding hands here, that we're actually looking out for each other? Tuesday on our Work segment, Beth Kobliner is here, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And we've asked our good friend Stephen Dubner from Super Freakonomics to stick around and try to get an assessment of whether this economic environment causes ethics to increase in the workplace or decrease. Now, are you a fan of The Office?
I love The Office.
Right, you guys watch The Office?
All the time.
Right. If you watch The Office, you could conclude very easily, maybe after a few minutes of watching the show, that in fact every workplace is just a venal, nasty kind of unethical hell.
If you're watching this video, you've been a very naughty person.
People are making alliances. It feels horrible.
I have learned some of your deepest, darkest secrets.
People hiding in various areas of the building, acting a little bit more moral. They're nervous. They just don't want to get caught.
And with this knowledge, I have the ability to ruin your world. But it needn't come to that.
If your ethics aren't in order nowadays with so many people out of work, you may possibly end up being one of them.
Scared into being ethical. We mixed up some real voices of people here in Lower Manhattan gathered by our own Femi Oke and that scene from The Office to make the point, can you even measure ethics in the workplace? Beth, the answer is yes.
Yes, you can. The Ethics Resource Center, a not-for-profit group right. has been doing this for 40 years, and they've done a survey, and they found that actually people are more ethical during tough economic times. They just came out with their survey today and showed that people are saying that there's less misconduct on the workplace. They're seeing less stealing, less bullying, even less sexual harassment.
All right, let's hold the numbers for just a second.
Okay.
Now, is this the kind of thing that drives a super freakonomist crazy, or is this the sort of thing we should be measuring in the way that Beth is talking about it here, Stephen Dubner?
It does drive me crazy, only in a methodological way. So let me say for the record, I love Beth and I love her book, and
right.
I think that all the work she does is really good. I think this is a great point to be exploring. My reservation here is that I never have that much trust of self-reported surveys on behaviors as hard to identify or as squishy as something like ethics. In other words, when we can measure hard behavior, like stealing. In other words, if we could measure stealing, we could measure claims of sexual harassment, if we could measure all these behaviors as opposed to asking people about what they see and what they witness, then I'd have more faith in it. That
so
doesn't mean it's not true.
Tonnage of paper leaving the office, that matters to you, but what people say doesn't.
Although this particular study asked that same question for 6 years in a row.
Wow.
So you're talking about a random sample of 3,000 people who asked the
That's
same
big.
Question. So you're seeing they found in the year 2000, during tough economic times, ethical behavior improved somewhat. During better economic times with those same questions, it went down. And then in turn, when the economy didn't get so good again, ethics went up. So
now,
I think you have some sort of, you know, I know what you're saying, but I do think that in this case, if you're asking the same question,
Let's grab the causality here for just a second, because Femi Okeh found some voices on the street saying that people are scared. That's why they're being more ethical. They don't want to get caught doing something. I don't know if that's necessarily ethics in the classic sense, but does the data show anything like that?
Right. I mean, I think what you're doing is coming down to the question, what is ethics? Or is it just this, you know, paranoia kicks in and it's a job protection mechanism? So is that ethical? You could even argue that's not ethical to be more better behavior just so you want to keep your job.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, you know, things like whistleblowing is actually increasing.
Uh-huh.
So is that ethical to, you know, tell on other workers? Or again, is it just sort of, you know, you're protecting yourself and your turf? And I think there are complicated issues. And then also I think there's the bigger question of ethics we've seen, you know, like banks that are getting huge amounts of taxpayer bailout money, and then they're giving out bigger bonuses. So is that, even though these reports are showing people are saying they're feeling more ethical, they're seeing more ethics in the workplace, in the big picture, if people feel that their government isn't being ethical or Wall Street isn't being ethical, and certainly the Bernie Madoffs of the world haven't been ethical, how does that all fit into this?
You know, Stephen, one of the things that occurs to me is that one of the reasons this may drive you crazy and I was thinking about was that maybe people's reporting of ethics changes in tough economic times.
Yeah, I find the story believable. I mean, to me, it makes sense that when people are worried about their jobs, they lie, cheat, and steal less. Absolutely. It makes perfect sense to
me. As opposed to them just being better people.
Yeah, and I think Beth is exactly right to say whether we call it ethics or not is really beside the point. I mean, I think we're going to talk about that later in the week. Whether we call it altruism or not is beside the point. If someone donates a kidney to my mother who's dying of kidney failure, I don't give a crap why. Honestly,
your mother's not dying of kidney failure.
No, she's already dead, unfortunately.
Right.
I wish that it were only a kidney that would.
Going right
no, that's okay.
Tank,
she had a long
Thanks,
and
happy
John. Life.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
Well, I just want
to
make
really
that clear.
Well, you bring that up.
Let's get back to sort of some practical suggestions here. What is an employer noting these trends in the workplace of workers who are maybe banding together? What do they do to either exploit it or to reward workers or to incentivize it? Is there any sort of takeaway from this study?
Well, interestingly enough, what's going on right now in all workplaces, our ethical training is down because of budget cuts. A lot of companies. So ethical training is down, but ethics are up. So I don't know what that says to the validity of ethical training, other than perhaps.
Have you ever been to ethical training?
What's the lag time between ethical training and ethical behavior?
Exactly. They claim that it's already been absorbed in the culture so that people all understand
right.
the ethics,
if it's
and that's
a lagging,
why it's working.
If ethics are a lagging indicator and ethics training is a leading indicator, then we're
maybe that's not where the ethics idea comes from. That's not where the ethos is in the office. It doesn't come from a top-down idea. It's a bottom-up idea. Maybe that's
exactly.
what the study's
I think
saying.
It's like a sandwich. I think it's top and bottom, but I do believe it's not from the human resources side. All the human resources people will hate me. I don't think it's a sort of you have to squash it down on people. I think it's when the boss of a company says, you know what, no matter what, if something bad happens, I want to know. I don't care if it increases our profitability. If it's illegal, we don't do it. We squash it at first. If that's the moral tone you set, then people stop stealing pencils. That's my opinion, and that's what I've been hearing.
That's great. I mean, 6 years of this study, sample of over 3,000, right? We can probably increase your sample a little bit, Beth. If you're noting trends in your workplace, more ethics in the office, fewer ethics in the office, more fear, which enforces a kind of ethical behavior, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Beth Koblenner, Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Thank you, Beth, and Stephen Dubner, of course. We will see you tomorrow to talk about altruism here on Super Freakonomics Wednesday.
If you do have a workplace story and if your coworkers are acting ethically, it's 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also hearing from you today on
mug.
Sarah Palin. Her new book is
my
out.
Computer.
Going Rogue, Don't Steal It Off Your Coworker's Desk. But we're asking you, if Sarah Palin has a sequel, what will the title be? David emails us. Title of the sequel to Sarah Palin's Going Rogue, Staying Vague.
Man. They're all good, but they're all negative.
Yeah, most of them, yeah.
Ethical,
when
yeah.
it comes to Palin, we actually wondered about how women are doing in the Republican Party. And here's your takeaway.
There are certain social issues that are being used now as a litmus test to determine your suitability for office. We're supposed to be solving the problems that the people in general care about. And most people don't worry about abortion rights or gay marriage. They worry about, can they pay the rent? What are they going to do about medication?
That's former New Jersey Governor Christy Todd Whitman.
I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. And that's my...
China stands up to the world. This 1964 propaganda film, East is Red, about Chairman Mao, declares that the Chinese people stood up and created the communist dictatorship that soon brought on the brutal Cultural Revolution. Today, as the internet brings on another kind of cultural revolution, President Obama visits China and learns from some blogging students that the Chinese people may be standing up, finally.
I'm quite happy with all the options I have on the internet right now. I can use microblogging to do my blog every day, and I can use instant messages to communicate with my friends. So I'm pretty happy with all the options I'm having right now.
Assessing freedom of expression in today's China. Looking out for those old red China blues on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Oh yeah, Miles Davis always makes it a better morning. Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, November 17th, I'm John Hockenberry, speaking Mandarin with my colleague Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, moving from Cuba to Illinois, the worst part of that may be the weather change. We're going to talk about moving Guantanamo Bay detainees to the American Midwest. We'll also talk about a football battle not on the field in the courtroom, and unbelievably influential rapper Rakim has a new CD out. Heard that name before? If you haven't, we'll tell you why you should.
But first, 20-year-old Jenny Jiang joins us. She's a junior at the University of Pennsylvania. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning.
Now, throughout the history of the People's Republic of China, leaders have always claimed that it is the people who rule, who stand up, who control things. Now, as absurd as that is historically, is it possible that the people are standing up these days with their use of the internet and digital media?
Well, I think that the standard for social media in China is a lot different from the culture of social media in the United States, but I think that Chinese people are definitely finding their own voice through social media in a very interesting way.
And how do you experience that?
I have some friends. Oh, actually, my parents are friends who have children about my age who try to engage me here in the States with social media all the time, and so I feel like it's actually a daily part of their lives now, whether or not it is used to enact some sort of political or social change in China.
Well, it's great, and we want to explore that experience with you in just a moment. Jenny Jiang will be back with you, but first, everything else you need to know this morning.
President Obama wraps up his 3-day visit to China today. Earlier, he had some tough words for the Chinese president in Beijing. He said it's time for China to re-engage with the Dalai Lama.
While we recognize that Tibet is part of the People's Republic of China, the United States supports the early resumption of dialogue between the Chinese government and representatives of the Dalai Lama to resolve any concerns and differences that the two sides may have.
Early in the program, we mentioned President Obama's comments yesterday about China censoring the internet. This morning, the Associated Press reports that Vietnam may be censoring the use of Facebook. The site's become more difficult to access during the past few weeks. Facebook has more than a million users in Vietnam.
And, of course, the rollout today of Going Rogue in American Life, Sarah Palin's memoir, has sparked a debate among women in the GOP. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to former Republican Governor of New Jersey, Christy Todd Whitman.
When I look at it, I look down the ballot a little bit, and the numbers get even more sort of dislocated at the state legislature level and the lower level, the mayoral level. And that's where we need to really put our focus and be encouraging of women.
Whitman says both parties should do more to promote women in politics. So the past few minutes, Spanish officials say Somali pirates have freed 36 hostages from a Spanish trawler being held off the coast of Somalia for the past 6 weeks. Markets open this hour with the Dow just above 10,400. The S&P is hovering around 1,100. The Nasdaq opens a shade under 2,200. So the Sarah Palin book is called Going Rogue in American Life, but is there a sequel?
Dale from Manhattan. Two suggestions for the sequel. One is It Takes a Quitter, and the other one is Gold Diggers of 2012.
John tweets us, almost from Russia with love. You clearly have some suggestions for Sarah Palin's sequel. If there is going to be one, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Obama and China in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Apparently, the immediate world wants to weigh in on our question of whether Sarah Palin's book has a sequel and what the title might be. We'll give you responses and let you hear some of your suggestions all through the hour at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But we begin with President Obama in China. And the U.S.-China relationship concerns a lot of new issues that we haven't heard before, but also the old issues, the old standbys. Here's Chinese President Hu Jintao speaking this morning.
President Obama, on various occasions, has reiterated that the U.S. side adheres to the One China policy, abides by the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques, and respects China's sovereignty and the territorial integrity when it comes to the Taiwan question.
There once was a time when the Taiwan question was virtually all of the U.S.-China relationship, but it's much broader than that today. And we're going to talk about, first of all, what's going on at the meetings in Beijing this morning, which will end up with a lavish state dinner tonight. Xiaorong Chen is a BBC China editor, joins us from London. Xiaorong, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk about the business that was, done today. There was a lot of talk about climate change. There was talk about economic issues. There was the talk there about the three China or the one China policy and the three communiques that Hu Jintao mentioned there. How would you, first of all, assess what's being done today?
I think the summit between the presidents of the two powers shows that the two countries are really working together. I think the tone of the visit has been described as positive and cooperative. I would say one word is missing, or two, which is comprehensive. The cooperation or the relationship between the two powers are not cooperating comprehensively as the Chinese would like, but the two sides have shown pragmatism in working on issues that they can work together, as you mentioned, climate change and reviving the global economy. But there's another issue, which is the nuclear non-proliferation, to try to get North Koreans and Iran out of nuclear arms development.
So, Xiaorong Chen, is it fair to say that there are at least three points of non-cooperation or disagreement, one involving nuclear non-proliferation, the other involving the float of the yuan, the Chinese currency? And I guess the third would be the candor that President Obama used in talking about Tibet and the Dalai Lama.
Well, on nuclear issues and nuclear non-proliferation, the two countries are working together. But the U.S. is trying to get China supporting its stance or policy towards Iran as well. That's one side of the issue. In terms of differences, of course, there are differences. For example, the United States is continuing its policy to support Taiwan, selling arms to Taiwan, Xinjiang, which the Beijing government is very angry with. Very often that can serve as a flashpoint between the two relationships. So that is something they will continue to work on. But the United States has said again and again that they are for a one China policy. There's only one China. But how the two sides across the Taiwan Strait solve their differences, that's a matter to them. A
lot of details, yes. Well, Xuong Chen, stay with us, because we mentioned at the top of the hour that we want to take a look, at least for a few minutes, at the notion of free expression in a digital 21st century China, where people are engaged in social networking arrangements of one kind or another. And of course, there are, you know, probably many more people in China who have no sort of digital connection whatsoever. But Jenny Jiang joins us, a junior at the University of Pennsylvania. She's 20 years old, majoring in marketing, has pretty much daily contacts with people in Beijing and across China. Jenny, you still with us? And I would say, without betraying too much in the way of age, David Zhang is an associate professor of pathology and oncological sciences at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, been in the United States since 1985. You are of a generation preceding Jenny Jiang's. And David Zhang, what would you say is your experience with free expression in China in the modern internet era?
Well, you know, I've been China, grew up in China, and especially I was born and grew up in Tibet. And I see that, you know, the big changes in terms of speech freedom and, you know, back to the 20, 30 years ago. And there's a lot of restrictions, what you can say, what you cannot say. And now, you know, if you go to China, you can talk to the people. And a very simple experience when you get right on taxis and you can talk to the taxi drivers. And they can tell you a lot of street news. And they can say who they like, who they don't they like. You know, I think it's much more open now than before.
Well, assess this then. Is it possible that people sort of know the limitations inside China and that that amounts to a kind of censorship and that everybody knows where they shouldn't go?
Well, I think that at this point, people are less worried about the censorship, and they say what they want to say. I think that only since there are limitations that they can't gather together and form a big group or demonstration, I think. But in terms of speech, they have pretty much freedoms, as we do in the U.S.
Jenny Jiang, is that your experience? And is there any discussion of a kind of a Tiananmen Square sort of digital confrontation with Chinese authorities regarding freedom in the internet?
My experience would be similar. Every time I've gone back to China, I think people don't really check themselves when they speak anymore. And in addition to this, I mean, I think plenty of people use social media in China. And even if things are blocked like Facebook and Twitter, I think people in China are pretty innovative and find ways to get around these things.
Let me just put that to Xuong Chen. Do both of these people describe a situation that has political significance in China in the sense that people are being candid, they express their freedom, and that the Chinese government maybe needs to watch if they are going to try to shut things down?
Well, I think it, in many ways, the revolution goes on. It's not just the technological revolution. People have grasped the vehicle of internet and try to express themselves. In fact, many of the issues are freely discussed, as David mentioned, on the internet. And sometimes these discussions are watched and viewed by the leadership, and some issues have been taken up, and some officials have been ousted through this kind of a public sort of vigilante, digital vigilante.
All right, well, let's ask that directly. Xuong Chen, of course, BBC China editor, speaking with us from London. David Zhang, you say you grew up in Tibet. Are you confident you could have a candid conversation about the Dalai Lama and not be watched or monitored by Chinese authorities?
Well, when you go to China, you know, like the Dalai Lama become less important figure. So, you know, people, you know, I just visited Tibet a couple weeks ago. And you go there, and it's life is pretty peace, and the people talk what they whatever they want to talk. But I think that, of course, the Dalai Lama issue is a sensitive issue in China, and I think that we can understand, you know, because, you know, being so many years here in the U.S. and also see China grow, and China looking for the stability.
And stability is the key issue in China. There's a snapshot of the situation through some Chinese voices here in the United States. David Zhang, thank you so much. Associate Professor of Pathology and Oncological Sciences at Mount Sinai Hospital here in New York, and Jenny Zhang, Jr. at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, 20-year-old marketing major. Thanks for being with us. And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's get a look at some headlines.
As we've been talking about, President Obama wraps up his three-day tour of China today. Then he'll head to South Korea for the end of his Asia trip. Earlier, the U.S. and Chinese leaders announced some areas of cooperation, including climate change.
Healthcare now. Opponents of the healthcare overhaul are outspending supporters at a rate of 2-1 for television ads. Those who don't like the Democratic healthcare plan have spent $24 million. Supporters have spent about $12 million. Finally, a little nugget we dug up for you today. In Germany, 14 people were left literally dangling upside down from a carnival ride that went wrong. But now they're recovering from a second big shock. They've each received a hefty bill for being rescued.
Oh, uh-oh. Boy.
Yeah, some ride.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to talk about a court case that means the Redskins in D.C. get to keep their controversial name. More on that in just a few minutes.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for a little table talk about takeouts on the news. You like that alliteration? We've got Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners in the New York Times, and Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway sports contributor, joins us this morning. Louise, let's go to business first, and this is also a government story. We're a few hours away from the beginning of a hearing.
Yeah.
And basically what they're looking into in this congressional committee is the government paid for a merger between Bank of America and Merrill Lynch.
The government gave bailout money that helped this merger get done.
And then once the merger was done, they then bailed out the new company that was formed by the merger.
There were two bailouts, and there's a lot of controversy around this. This is going to be a very colorful hearing because you've got four people there with a kind of checkered past. So you've got two members of Bank of America's board of directors who exchanged emails around the time of this second bailout saying things like, unfortunately, it screwed the shareholders. Then you've got Brian Moynihan, who may be the next CEO. People say he's a leading contender, but he was all over the legal decisions at the end of this merger. And then you've also got Tim Mayopoulos, who's the former general counsel and was mysteriously fired. And they released their prepared testimonies ahead. I was reading them last night, and one that really struck me was Tim Mayopoulos's, because he describes how he was fired, which for all those people out there losing jobs is stunning because he was a very senior executive there. He says, the HR representative came in and gave me my severance papers, took my corporate ID card, company credit card, BlackBerry, and office keys. He reiterated I could take nothing with me and my personal effects would be sent to me. He then escorted me to the executive's parking garage. I got in my car and drove home. I was stunned.
We'll see what he has to say.
Lucky his car started.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure people are waiting with bated breath to see what he has to say in front of the hearing today. That's Louise Story, finance reporter for the New York Times.
We go now to Washington. Todd Zwillick is around the takeout table this morning. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, John. Good morning.
So yesterday, Senator Lugar of Indiana, okay, Richard Lugar, huge senior senator, gets up to speak, and he's commenting on comments of his own colleague, his own Republican colleague, Jeff Sessions, talking about one of these federal judge appointments of the Obama administration. Are there cracks in this decades-long, it seems, battle over federal judgeships between the Democrats and the Republicans?
It appears that there may be, John. Lugar was talking about David Hamilton, who is Barack Obama's first nominee to the federal bench. He was nominated back in March to the Seventh Circuit. Jeff Sessions is the senior Republican on the Judiciary Committee, and he's trying to lead a filibuster against this guy. Lugar
and called him an activist, called him abusing his power, and really took him to task.
Yeah, he really did. He sort of Sessions went point by point, saying that Hamilton wasn't qualified. He's an activist. He's made rulings against religious prayer in state legislatures. And Lugar came back and went point by point and said Sessions is wrong. He also said we have to get past the sort of politicizing of judicial nominees. And you're right. This goes back decades through the nuclear option fights between Republican and Democratic presidents and Republican and Democratic senates.
We should point out that Lugar has a kind of a personal interest here. David Hamilton is a favorite son. He's from Indiana. But still, if you add this to Lindsey Graham voting for Sotomayor, okay?
Yeah.
Is it possible that Republicans are maybe losing their consensus over fighting these judgeships?
Well, Lindsey Graham has said that he wants to depoliticize these things. Lugar said that he wants to depoliticize them as well. But I don't think these fights are over, because this does go back decades. And I think maybe the next time you see a judge that's not from Richard Lugar's home state, maybe he'll vote with Republicans on this stuff. You know, everybody always wants to defuse these things. But, John, they raise so much money and they make so much political red meat over judicial nominations on both sides. Don't be surprised if it comes back.
Well, this one only comes back a few decades. We want to talk to you about something that goes back centuries. Todd, stay with us, okay?
I will.
There's your takeout from Washington.
Now time for sports takeout with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So we're going to talk about a football battle, but it took place off the field. We're even way off the field.
Rah, 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 hail to the Redskins, hail victory.
That's hail to the Redskins. The next line there is Braves on the Warpath. That's the 1960s fight song for the Washington, D.C. football team. The football team actually just won a court battle to a certain extent over their name, the Redskins. Some people have been trying to get them to change the name for the Redskins, saying it's very offensive to Native Americans. And the Supreme Court decided not to hear this case, essentially letting stand the decision that they can keep that name.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court basically took the laches principle, which is it's an old doctrine. It basically means that they slept on their rights. They slept on their rights to have a – and essentially they threw it out on a technicality.
Called it a trademark.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right. And so even if they had won, the trademark would have disallowed – they could have still sold, you know, tickets, had players, you know, had a team, the whole nine. They wouldn't necessarily have to had to completely disbar the logo from being used. So I think that that's a little – misunderstood in this story is that even if they had won, they wouldn't have basically had a no Redskins team. You wouldn't have had to rename
the
team.
They wouldn't have to rename the team.
Exactly.
How does this play down in Washington, Todd?
Well, this stuff has been going on for a long time. It's not only the home of the government, but the home of the Redskins. People love the Redskins. I'm not quite sure why at this point, but maybe because they're so bad this year. But Ibrahim is right. They didn't actually rule on whether the name is offensive or racist, but there are other cases that do go to that point. It'll take years, but this could actually come back.
There is another – I'm sorry.
It's the Fighting Sioux in North Dakota.
Right.
Yeah.
There's another case, but also the interesting part is that Justice Samuel Alito, when he was on the Third Circuit, he said the disparaging trademark could be challenged at any time. So there's some dispute that if it had gotten there, then maybe you would have had a little bit more of a robust, vigorous debate about whether that could
and
have been.
And sports is a pivot point for huge social changes in the United States. The color line in baseball, this is probably one of them.
But this is not a final decision on offensive names. It's certainly not offensive names.
Not at all.
In football teams anywhere. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is a Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks so much, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, where do we send Guantanamo Bay detainees if we close the facility in Cuba? Well, we might be sending them to Illinois. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama, speaking in Beijing this morning, said the U.S. and China agreed to take significant steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
As President Hu indicated, we are creating a joint clean energy research center and have achieved agreements on energy efficiency, renewable energy, cleaner uses of coal, electric vehicles, and shale gas.
President Obama also attended a state dinner in his honor. He wraps up his three-day trip to China in a few hours before traveling to South Korea. Hunger is on the rise in the U.S. New government figures show 17 million American households, or 15% of the country, had difficulty putting enough food on the table at some point last year. That's an 11% rise over 2007.
It's already a bestseller. Sarah Palin's memoir, Going Rogue, An American Life, hits bookstores today officially, and pre-orders have been keeping that aloft. Also, interviews on the Oprah program. The most corrupt country in the world, according to a report from an international watchdog group, is Somalia. Afghanistan, Myanmar, Sudan, and Iraq round out the top five. Singapore topped the list as the most principled country. The U.S. came in at 19. After 5 hours of grueling competition, hold on to your seats, folks, a Michigan man won the Rock, Paper, Scissors World Championship. Tim Conrad faced off against his best friend in the first All-American title in championship history and took him down with paper covering rock.
Paper
beats rock. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
President Obama has made no secret that he wants to close down the detention center in Guantanamo Bay, but in order to do that, he's got to find a place for the detainees, and that's a very controversial subject. Republicans are leading the charge to oppose bringing these suspects to United States soil. Others favor the plan because hosting a prison for Guantanamo Bay detainees could bring jobs to their area. One of the places the government is considering is the Thompson Correctional Center in northwestern Illinois. Joining us with details now is Tony Arnold from Chicago Public Radio. He's been covering this story. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Give us the lowdown on this story. First of all, how large is the Thompson Correctional Center and how far is it from Chicago?
Thompson is located about 150 miles west of Chicago, so it's basically right on the Mississippi River, right next to Iowa. It's about as far west in Illinois as you can possibly get. And it's a very rural part of the state, a lot of farmland around there, obviously. And as for the Thompson Correctional Center itself, it's fairly small. It holds about 200 people, and for the most part, it's being used right now as a minimum security prison, although it has maximum security capabilities. It's just not being used right now. When it was built about 8 years ago, the state didn't exactly have the money to operate it. It had the money to build it, but just not operate it.
It's capable of holding maximum security prisoners, but they haven't been able to afford that, right?
Correct, right.
Now, Illinois is hardly the only place that the government is looking to possibly house Guantanamo Bay detainees. We are also looking at facilities in Florence, Colorado, Hardin, Montana, Standish, Michigan. And we actually spoke with the mayor of Standish, Michigan, and he said most of their residents are in support of bringing the Guantanamo Bay detainees there because they feel like it'll be an economic boon for their community. Tony, is that what you're hearing in Illinois as well?
That's exactly what I'm hearing also. The town of Thompson really seems to be pretty excited about the possibilities of creating more jobs, and the senators here who have been pushing for this, the Democratic senators, have said that this could create anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 jobs in Thompson, which is, and like I said, it's being a rural part of the state, there's not much out there in terms of industry or any kind of hasn't seen much of an economic growth in any recent years.
Okay,
so this really could be a big boon for them.
Well, let's talk to the guy that actually represents that area in Illinois, Representative Mike Boland. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thompson is part of your constituency, and have you spoken with residents who are around the correctional facility there, or do they agree with what you just heard Tony saying?
Oh, absolutely. I've talked to them actually over the last 8 to 10 years, and they're very enthused about it. You know, we waited a long, long time to get it fully opened, and this will actually bring in over 3,000 jobs. The governor estimates about 3,200, and also there'll probably be about 1,000 additional jobs in schools and restaurants and motels and other type of ancillary economic development.
Well, Representative, let me ask you to listen to this. This is from one of your colleagues, Representative Mark Kirk, and he is arguing that bringing terrorists to Chicago is going to make Illinois a terrorist target.
With the busiest airport in the world and the tallest building in North America, I do not think that we should make Chicagoland the center of jihadi attention in the world. But if you concentrate four times the number of terrorists of anywhere else in the country, in Illinois, you will make us ground zero for that attention.
Representative Mike Boland, what do you have to say to that? Is this going to make you guys a target?
That, no, not at all. You know, Mark Kirk is running for the U.S. Senate here, and it's all a political sham what they're putting out. We already have a federal prison in Illinois. It's in southern Illinois in a place called Marion, and they already have 30-some, I guess you'd call them terrorists, prisoners there right now. They already have John Gotti. They've got mafia leaders. They've got some of the leaders of the most violent street gangs in Chicago, you know, and there hasn't been any security problems as of yet, and I doubt that there ever will be. The people in that area feel very secure, and I don't think that's going to happen. You know, those types of things could happen. Chicago could have been a target before all these years, and they have not been. We have to depend upon our federal authorities, our FBI, CIA, and all the other intelligence groups and the national defense apparatus to protect us from any kind of terrorist attack, which could happen anywhere.
Okay, Tony Arlen.
The Gitmo prisoners are going to be scattered in different places across the country, so I don't see that Chicago is going to be any kind of particular target.
So, Tony Arnold, you're with Chicago Public Radio. You just heard Representative Mike Boland talking about how this is not a credible argument. How strong is the opposition to bringing this prison to Illinois, and is it just Republicans? Is it only political?
It has become a very strong political matchup in this instance. The Republicans yesterday, four Illinois Republicans, congressmen, gathered throughout northern Illinois, partly from Chicago, the suburbs, and also the representative who represents Thompson, Illinois, all showed up in opposition to this for some of the same reasons that you just heard. The other thing is basically their argument was that Guantanamo Bay is not going to be closing. It's going to be moving to Thompson, Illinois, if this were the case. Now, the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons addressed this kind of fear of having visitors come through Illinois to visit these detainees yesterday. He toured the facility in Thompson and said that these prisoners, these detainees, would not be allowed access to having visitors. And so that kind of put a hole in the Republicans' argument that you'd have potential terrorists, I guess, coming through Chicago to come to Thompson to visit these detainees.
And it looks like they have it set it up where there's actually going to be three guards for every Guantanamo prison there should they end up getting located at the Thompson Correctional Center Northwest Illinois. That's right. It's about jobs. That was Tony Arnold, a reporter for Chicago Public Radio. We also heard from Representative Mike Boland, the state representative of the 71st District that includes the village of Thompson. Thanks to both of you.
I wonder if that's a higher or lower ratio than is already at Gitmo.
Oh, that's a good question.
Guards.
I wonder.
I wonder if they increase the number
of
guards.
It's a much higher ratio than it is at the current state prisons. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, I need to hear a launch of the space shuttle one more time, okay? Because I kind of forget what it sounds like.
3, 2, 1, 0, and liftoff of Space Shuttle Atlantis on a mission to build, resupply, and to do research.
Yeah, well, the Atlantis took off on the 16th of November. That's yesterday. And it's hauling spare parts into space to actually help out the International Space Center. Miles O'Brien joins us, freelance science and aviation reporter, on the line from Cocoa Beach. Good morning.
3, 2, 1.
You nailed it, Miles. Well, first of all, you know, I found this story this morning. We've mentioned it a couple of times. There's this project, aside from bringing the the spare parts to the International Space Station, there's this experiment to test the zero gravity on muscle tissue by hauling worms into space. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. Why not? And actually, you know, what's interesting about this is that project actually has its roots in the Columbia accident. So that's an experiment that began there. So there's
really
a legacy there. You know, it's interesting. I was talking to a guy yesterday, too, who brought over a vial of staph infection or simulated staph infection.
I love your friends,
Miles. Follow that around. And what's very interesting is the staph infection becomes much more virulent in space. So the absence of gravity does some weird things to all kinds of things that we would like to address here on Earth.
Now, virulent in the sense that it's more communicable to astronauts in the space station, or
well,
it somehow changes the bacteria itself?
It changes the bacteria itself, makes it kind of, you know, gives it a dose of steroids, if you will, for lack of a better term. And as a result, they can study it better. So, you know, staph infections kill thousands of people in hospitals. You want to get sick, go to a hospital. And who knows, maybe somewhere up there in space, they'll be able to come up with some solution for addressing a problem like that. This is the kinds of things that the absence of gravity can give you when you're talking about science and weightlessness.
So, Miles, did you happen to look at the packing list of the spare parts they're hauling up to the space station? A lot of new VCRs and Blu-ray machines and coffee machines and stuff like that?
Yeah, they got to stock in the movies up there. You know, it's a long day up there. The big thing are these big gyroscopes. You know, we've only got, after this launch now, there's only five more shuttle launches, and as you know. And they have these 600-pound gyroscopes that sit on the outside of the station to keep it from flying cattywomper, and they're bringing up two spares because once the shuttle goes away, there's no other way to get those things up there. So that's the biggie. And then there's, you know, a lot of other, you know, food and canisters filled with various gases that you need and all that kind of stuff.
Replacement filters.
The resupply issue is a problem as the shuttle winds down.
So what time did you get up this morning, Miles?
I was up late. I was up at 1 a.m., went out to the beach here at Cocoa Beach, looked
and?
To the east. And
what'd you see?
A bit of a dud.
What'd you see?
I saw three in 10 minutes, and then I got
three
tired.
Leonid meteors. The Leonid meteor shower has only been going on for about, 7-8 million years. It's the remains of some comet that passes through our atmosphere once a year about this time, right?
Yeah, Temple Tuttle. And this is the tail of that comet. You know, comets are dirty snowballs, as you know, and the tail is just a bunch of sand and dust and particles and ice. And as we pass through the orbit of Temple Tuttle once a year, depending on the year, we can get quite a show. I would say it was kind of a mid to low range.
This one's
show
mid
last
to low.
Night, but,
all right.
But it was kind of fun.
Miles O'Brien says, dud. Okay. Freelance science and aviation reporter and our friend here on The Takeaway. Miles, thanks so much.
Goodness gracious, quick balls of fire.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, hip-hop artist Rakim releases his third solo album today. Don't recognize that name? There's probably a lot of you that don't, but we're going to tell you why you should hear more about him in just a few minutes. We're also talking today about Sarah Palin's new book. It's called Going Rogue, An American Life. Hits the bookshelves today, and we're asking you...
It's already on Craigslist.
Really?
Yeah.
Does Sarah Palin have a sequel? And if so, what would the title be?
Hey, this is Willie Brooklyn. The name of the next book, How About the Audacity of Dope?
This is Josh. I think Sarah Palin's next book should be called Going Vogue.
Richie emails us, I hope she has the sense to go back to Alaska, therefore I propose Going Gnome.
That's my favorite.
I'd like to invite Republicans to write it. It can't be all people who you know.
We don't know if these are Democrats, actually.
Well, let me say, let's talk about Palin lovers. Let's hear from Palin lovers what would the title of her new book be. 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. President Obama wraps up his three-day tour of China today, and then he'll head off to South Korea for the end of his trip to the Far East. Back at home, as we said, Sarah Palin is making the interview rounds to promote her new book.
Going Rogue, The Moose Diaries? Maybe that would be the Palin Lover sequel title.
Maybe.
Going Rogue, The Moose Diaries. All right, hunger is on the rise in the U.S. That's a serious story. New government figures show 17 million American households, or 15% of the country, had a difficult time putting enough food on the table at some point last year, and that's an 11% increase over 2007. In Australia, a team of 16 surgeons and nurses have finished 25 hours of surgery to separate twin Bangladeshi girls who were joined at the heads. The girls shared blood vessels and brain tissue. Too early to tell whether the operation was a success. These are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Here's a sip for the crew that's deceased. If I get revenge, then they rest in peace.
Somebody got a self, I just might spare one and give a brother a fair one.
Now that's a voice I recognize. That is hip-hop artist Rakim. He releases his third solo album today called The Seventh Seal. You may not recognize that voice, though, because this is a guy who, although he's influenced many hip-hop artists that we know very, very well, he's not well-known across the country today. This is Rakim's first solo album in 9 years, highly anticipated by those who know him. And if you're too young to remember 9 years ago or too old for Rakim's music to be relevant for you, we've got Professor David Wall Rice here from Clark University to explain why you should know more about Rakim. Good morning, David.
Hey, Celeste. How are you?
Good. So I know Rakim, but lots of people don't, although they've heard his, they've certainly heard the influence of his music, right?
Absolutely. Sure. They sure have.
Who is this guy, and why should we be caring about his new album?
Well, they tell me I can have a little bit of fun this morning, so instead of answering that question outright, let's go ahead and play this from an artist you might find more familiar, or listeners might find more familiar.
Go for it. Whatever you say is wrong, whatever I say is right. You think of my name now whenever you say hi. Became a commodity because I'm W-H-I-T-E, because MTV was so friendly to me. Can't wait till Kim sees me. Now is it worth it? Look at my life. How is it perfect?
Okay, so, you know, I just came from Detroit. That, of course, is Detroit's favorite hip-hop son, Eminem.
Celeste, you are really cool. Yeah, that actually is Celeste. That's Eminem, and that's from his 2001 hit, I'm Back. And now, what a lot of people might not realize, you, of course, not included, being familiar with Rakim and Eminem, is that Eminem got that inspiration from that song largely from Rakim's 1990 release, My Melody. And in putting the song together, well, again, let's kind of listen to a music sample of it. Turn up the bass, check out my melody, hand out a cigar. I'm letting knowledge be born, and my name's the R. A.K.A. I am not like the rest of them, I'm not on the list. Catch what I'm saying, I drop minds like a scientist. My melody's in the codes, the very next episode.
The interesting thing
you might notice there, Celeste, is that there's similarity in theme, rhythm, alliteration, all that kind of stuff. And so what's so intriguing is that it's not only Eminem, who is, of course, a multi-platinum selling artist that Rakim has influenced, but also the likes of Tupac and Jay-Z and Nas, and they all seem to pay tribute and respect to Rakim and their music. So, and even Rage Against This Machine, of course, which is a metal rock rap.
Yeah, you might not expect
Zach
it.
Zach De La Rocha also were influenced by Rakim, and here let's listen to a little bit of them as well. I was a fiend before I became a teen. I melted microphones instead of cones of ice cream. Music orientated. So when hip-hop was originated, fitted like pieces of puzzle, complicated.
That is not the version of the song that I know, actually. The one that I have is from my album that came from Eric B. and Rakim, right? In 1990.
That's right. The 1990 version of it. That's right.
Let's hear a little bit of the original version of that song, the way that I remember it. I was a fiend before I became a teen. I melted microphones instead of cones of ice cream. Music orientated. So when hip-hop was originated, fitted like pieces of puzzle, complicated. Okay, so David, you know, let me tell you what I like about Rakim, and being not an expert in any way, shape, or form about hip-hop, maybe you can tell me if that's what critics like about him, okay? I mean, number one, he's laid back. He's like the hip-hop guy with groove. And he's just got this really easy, very non-rush, not pressure, it's not, doesn't feel intense. But the other thing I really like about Rakim is, as a mom, I can play this music at home because there's not a huge amount of profanity in there. There's not extremely violent lyrics. So we're talking about major constant changes in rhythm, a master of rhyme, laid back, and not offensive.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is like one of the songs that I played for my now 2-year-old son in utero. So certainly, you know, in terms of having some significant kind of influence, of course, I bring it home. But also, you know, he's had a wide-ranging amount of influence just because he's kind of like that cool older brother. And so he seems to talk and people listen. He hasn't particularly reinvented himself. He's remained consistent to a formula that people have respected. And I think that his level of authenticity, folks really appreciate. And they, you know, they show him love.
He's not Madonna, you're saying. He doesn't have a new incarnation of himself with every album.
No, you're not going to hear a dance or electro track from Rakim anytime soon.
Right. So, you know, if what you're saying and what I'm saying is true, that he has been so influential, how come nobody knows, well, very few people know the name of Rakim?
Well, you know, I think that there's so many different ways to go at that. I think the people who need to know No, I was actually talking to Ice Cube last week in collaboration with this book that we're trying to do. And he says, if I'm not cool enough for you to get my rhymes, then you don't need to hear them. And I think that kind of speaks to Rakim as well. Folks who need to know him do know him, and you probably have heard of him before. He actually has, you know, been on several notable soundtracks and whatnot. And he just has not felt the need to, quote-unquote, sell out, sign to big labels. He's coming out independent on this release today. And people, again, respect him for it.
And he talks about God a lot. Since you talk about your new book coming out soon, which is about identity and public narratives, the name of your book is I Ain't No Joke, and that's actually the title of one of his songs from his first album.
I ain't no joke. I used to let the mic smoke. Now I slam it when I'm gonna make sure it's broke. When I'm gone, no one gets on, cause I won't let nobody press up and mess up the scene I set.
Now that is old school hip hop, if I ever heard it before. That is Rakim, Ain't No Joke, off of his first album, Paid in Full. His new album is coming out today. It's called The Seventh Seal. We're gonna go out on a little bit from his song, Walk These Streets. That was David Wall Rice speaking with us. He's a psychology professor with Morehouse College's Identity Stasis Lab, and author of the new book, Identity Through Public Narratives. It's called I Ain't No Joke. Thanks, David. This is Rakim, a single off his first album.
Perform in cities, hoes, and slums. The best sellers draw, and money is the only thing that get love. They say don't let it make you, but that's how they rate you. And the more you got, the more they hate. That's okay too. Just don't.
So add Rakim to your playlist by going to our website, thetakeaway.org, and you can listen to David Wall Rice and that interview all over again on our podcast. You can subscribe at iTunes or at our website. We're also talking with you about Sarah Palin's new book, Going Rogue in American Life. Does Palin have a sequel? Obama did before he became president. What would be the title of the Palin sequel?
This is Desmond from Detroit. I think Sarah Palin's next book should be titled How to Put Lipstick on a Pig.
Hi, my name is Carrie. I'm calling from Montclair, New Jersey. And my idea for Sarah Palin's next book is that it should be titled The Trite Stuff.
Little Tom Tim, Wolf there. I like that.
Yeah, and Tim in Brooklyn emails, you betchanomics. How having no coherent understanding of policy whatsoever became a winning advantage once they merged the presidential election with American Idol?
I don't know if that subtitle works.
It's not very catchy.
Aren't there any Palin lovers out there?
Hey, this is Gilligan Stump from New York City. I think Sarah Palin's new book should be entitled, Why Is Everyone Yawning?
That's
harsh. Harsh. It may be harsh against us. Give us your take on anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And here's one idea on how to get a little balance.
Hi, DJ from New Jersey. Since your audience is probably mostly liberal and Democratic, it would be more interesting if you asked them, if the question were regarding Palin, what is it that you like about Sarah Palin?
That's a good question. What
do
you? Let's try it. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway. The glasses I like. I like the hair is nice. Yeah.
I like the glasses.
Yeah. Russia. I like that. Alaska.
I like Alaska.
Alaska's great. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.